was 24 years old, and my guitar player boyfriend, who I was irrationally in love with, came home from tour to inform me I had been replaced with a girl he met that weekend in Seattle. It was like someone had taken a meat tenderizer to me. The story I had told myself is that if such a cool, handsome guy wanted to be with me, it must mean that I'm lovable. It must mean that I have purpose and a future, that I'm desirable and worth something. These attributes were conferred to me through the relationship. And so when I was replaced, it felt like they were transferred to someone else. Or that's what I told myself. So when I cried my 24-year-old self to sleep, thinking my worth and lovability and purpose had left with the guitar player, I had no idea that the story was still being written. I did not know that in the fall of 2016, when I was 47 years old, that I would be on an airplane bound for Boston with a man I had been dating for 6 weeks, and that he would lean over, kiss my cheek, and softly ask, "Nadia, when did you forgive me?" And I would answer, "When I realized that so much of my suffering from our breakup was a result not of your actions, but of the story I was telling myself about your actions." The guitar player is still handsome, but he doesn't play much anymore. He's a single dad and a software engineer and a magnificent human. He is as much of a different person now as I am, and we are happily in love again. And even so, who knows how this chapter might end? All of that is to say, we tell ourselves stories about who we are and what we deserve and what the events of our lives mean, and then we commit this all to memory and we repeat it to ourselves and to others over and over as if it's fact. We assume there is a period where really, quite often, there is actually a comma. I'm Nadia Boltzweber, and you've stepped into the confessional. It's like a car wash for our shame and secrets. Today, I talked to someone who ran away at 13, got arrested, hurt everyone they loved, and yet whose story unfolded in beautiful and surprising ways. Hey, confessional listeners, I just want to thank you for supporting this podcast. And I wanted you to know that there's a place called The Corners where I regularly engage with readers, post essays and prayers and bonus content from this podcast. It's called The Corners because it can feel as though some of us have been relegated to the edge of every space we are in. But here's the thing, I love The Corner. I always have. It's where I always choose to sit. Because from there, you can see the whole room. And because I love the other people who hang out there. I love outcasts and queers and the girls who talk too loud. Because I love the kind of humor that comes out of lives that have not been easy. Because I love sober drunks and single dads and sex workers and the guy who lost a leg in the war. Because these are my people. And you can join us and engage with me and my work at nadiaboltzweber.substack.com. That's nadiaboltzweber.substack.com. Join other folks who share my love of grace, snark, confession, mercy, pop culture, and of course, God. We'll see you there. Joining me in the confessional today is Lenny Duncan. Lenny is the author of an amazing book called Dear Church, a love letter from a Black preacher to the whitest denomination in America. Welcome, Lenny. What brings you into the confessional today?
So there was a lot of physical abuse in my home, and there was a lot of emotional abuse. And my parents were really strung out. I mean, you know, like shooting dope every day, shooting a lot of dope, like a bundle of dope every day. And I'd experienced a lot of violence, a lot of physical violence, a lot of watching my mom be beaten until she can't walk. you know, and this was like a weekly occurrence. And so when I was about 13, this notion came to me that I'd be better off on my own. And I think it was a God-given notion. I don't think it was, you know, I really think it was God speaking to me.
That's amazing. You never hear people say that. People are like, oh, this is a horrible,
yeah,
like misguided, you're going to destroy yourself thing.
No.
So that's interesting for you to say it that way.
It was because, so, you know, and look, at first I had some tough times, you know, I had to be a sex worker at one point to survive, you know, 13 years old. I also, you know, ran into some kids who said, you know, you don't have to do this, hop in our van. And I ended up on Grateful Dead tour and Fish tour and in the festival scene. And that's why I have like such a love for that. So when people meet me, I'm always talking about Black liberation and Black culture. And then they see me at like 10 Fish shows in a row. And they're like, this one of these things is not like the other.
I
right?
I love that.
And that's just because that scene embraced me. And when you were 13 years old in the 90s, there were very few safe places to go if you were on your own than Grateful Dead tour.
All right. So you find your home on the road and you have this vagabond experience. But I know you well enough to know that you eventually found your way back to Philadelphia, right?
Yeah. So I was about 19 years old and I had just come back. My mom was willing to have me home. And look, she wanted me home from the day I left. What mother doesn't?
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm working at a gas station on Haverford Avenue. By the time I was done with it, they called it the grass station.
Why would that be, Lenny Duncan?
So it's like one of those like classic like East Coast gas stations where you can't, you know, like everything comes through a metal drawer.
Yes,
you know what I mean? Yeah. Like late at night, except it's like that 24/7.
Yeah.
And I was like selling 20 bags out of it, you know, a pot and hanging out. And there was a church across the street. And I saw this kind of, you know, I knew they were church girls, but they dressed like hippies and they were cute. Mm. And I noticed one of them because like, I don't know about you, but I just have this instinct. I always know the one stray from the flock, right? I noticed one would go smoke cigarettes by herself. And my friends introduced me to her and we started dating.
Describe this girl.
She has brown hair. She's short and was very introverted. She was the first introverted person I was ever attracted to.
Hmm.
And what I didn't realize is that she had a gentleness to her and a way of moving about the world that I didn't have because of the way I was raised versus the way she was raised.
How was she raised?
She was raised in a very loving home. I mean, listen, they fucked up 100 times, but the intention was always love.
Hmm.
And, you know, we start sleeping together. I'm into her, but I also don't have the capacity to love anyone.
What do you mean by that?
Like, I think what I'm doing is love, but it's not.
Mm.
I thought love was sleeping together and making promises I couldn't keep, but I'm not going to pull it off because the shoe's going to drop and I'm going to drink myself almost into a coma, or I'm going to drug myself into another universe and I'm going to ruin everything that we've built together.
All right, so you love this girl as best you can.
Yeah, best I can.
In the way that you can when you're 19. And she's a nice white girl, Christian white girl from the suburbs.
Yes.
And then what happened?
She gets pregnant. And she's in the kind of household where there's not even a discussion on whether or not we're keeping the child.
Okay.
And I just do what I always do at that point. I wanted to be a father in a way that my father never could. Maybe part of it was I was afraid that the same abusive patterns I would repeat, you know, that I knew I was 70% likely to be like my father. So there was that fear. But I just didn't show up. You know, I just, you know, I made promises my ass couldn't cash. And by this point, I'm getting the idea that I'm that kind of person. I get arrested for selling LSD at the folk festival outside of, because I was going to get money to put up, right, to help with this kid. And so how I found out that I had a girl, I was on the top bunk of my jail cell in Montgomery County. And they slid a letter under the door at like 3 a.m, which was really unusual. Usually like mail call was earlier, and I jumped down to see what it is, and you know, it's for me, and I never get mail. I always wonder what where my mom's head was at in these moments, right? Because she couldn't even afford to send me money while I was in jail so I could eat. But yet she took like 3 hours to write a letter, which was hard for her, and make a card, you know? So she drew like all these stars and ribbons and written, like she like definitely genders it. It's a girl, you know, bright pink, you know, but she's trying to share joy that she has a grandchild. As she's writing to her son who's in jail about the kid that the mother says he's not allowed to see.
Yeah.
Right? So like, how do you find joy in those moments? So what I remember is how the handwriting was like in this perfect cursive. And how when I opened the letter, there were sparkles on it. And the way it glinted off the low light they always keep you in jail. The lights are never always out. And looking at the really flourish, it's a girl. It takes up half the page. And her name is Jenna. Right? Because I didn't get to name my daughter.
Oh, man.
Right? And like the promises that you make to God in those moments.
So, okay, you're in that moment and like you're looking at this cheery as fuck card.
Yeah.
In the name you didn't get to choose, and all the sparkles off the low light in the jail.
Yeah.
And what were you thinking?
I was thinking that I had completely become everything I promised I wouldn't be when I left home at 13. That all the things that I had left home to avoid, all the patterns I was trying to break, I had become those in a very real way. And it didn't matter that I wasn't physically abusive or emotionally abusive. I was still abusive. I still wasn't showing up. I was still, you know, I believe
hurting people you love.
Hurting people I love. You know, and that's a form of abuse. I think not being present for people who really need us is a form of spiritual and emotional abuse. So I was still, you know, in that moment thinking about how I completely failed everything I wanted to do in life. I got out of jail and I tried to get my shit together. I move back in with my parents. I get a little job, you know, I think I got a job at a trash company. Me and Bree sort of reconcile, and she ends up moving in with me in this little apartment.
With your parents?
With my parents. So now I've got this 17-year-old girl from the suburbs in my neighborhood, living in the same apartment that my parents could never get out of, stealing diapers and formula. And it's bad, Nadia. It's bad. And so we start talking about, like, what can we do that's different? And so I decided I'm going to go to Denver because I've had good times in Denver and in Boulder in particular. And I'm going to move back to Colorado and I'm going to take them with me.
Yeah.
But at my core, I knew that this was a way out and I knew that I wouldn't be able to pull it off. And the scariest thing for me at the time is that I was starting to be okay with not being able to pull anything off in my life.
That's a dangerous point, Lenny.
I know.
Yeah.
I was okay with it. I was okay like knowing that I would fail, knowing that I wouldn't show up. And those are secret moments, right? Those are moments you have right before your head hits the pillow.
Totally. My sort of thing around that was I became genuinely okay with the idea that I wouldn't live to 30.
Yeah.
Like it didn't bother me. It wasn't something I was fighting. I was like, no, there's nothing I can do about that. And I was okay with it, you know?
Yeah, I was surprised to be alive at 19 and surprised to be in the situation I was in.
But okay, at the same time, you had a big plan, right? Like you were going to go to Boulder and set up a new life. Bree and Jenna would follow at some point. That was the plan. But what actually happened?
I go to 11th and Filbert, which is where the Greyhound station is. And I get on the bus and I'm sitting in the back where I always sit. You know, where you get that nice smell of like, you know, a freshly clean Greyhound toilet, which smells like freedom to me. at that age, right? It just does. Because it means I'm getting out of my, whatever current jackpot I put myself in.
Oh, wow.
And I head out here. I work with my friend Jim for a while. I live in this place. I'm communicating with Bree. I'm trying. And, you know, someone just walks up to me one day while I'm hanging out in Boulder. And they're like, you want to do some speed? And I was like, hell yeah. And I do some speed and I just fall off the map. And I didn't see my daughter for 13 years after that.
Hey friends, I just wanted to thank you for listening and to let you know that if you want to support the podcast even more, you can head over to iTunes where you can rate it and even more importantly, where you can write a review. It's really the best way to help make sure other people find out about The Confessional. And if you'd like to hear and read more from me, you can sign up for my free newsletter and receive regular essays and prayers and, let's be honest, a whole lot of opinions over at nadiaboltzweber.substack.com. That's nadiaboltzweber.substack.com. That's my little corner of the internet called, appropriately enough, The Corners. See you there. Thanks so much. So, Lenny, when you left Bree and baby Jenna in Philadelphia and you went to Colorado and you didn't see your daughter for 13 years, what was transpiring in your own life over that period of time?
What would happen from 19 to almost 30 years old would be a descent into some of the darkest and ugliest places of alcoholism and addiction in the prison industrial complex. And so I have this act of providence happen in my life where a voice deep down inside me tells me I'm getting sober today. And I was like, what? And I did. I'm in a 12-step program. And, you know, the funny thing about 12 steps is when you get to step 9, which is making amends wherever possible, right? Not whenever, because whenever is never, wherever.
Mm-hmm.
The funny thing about that is that no matter how many times you go through the steps, that daughter you never met really is there.
Wow.
And finally, like my second or third year sober, I had a sponsor who said, you know, we get to that point. And, you know, my sponsor said, you know, you need to write down all the ways that you've harmed everyone that you've ever harmed and keep them on index cards in your wallet. You had to carry them around with you. And Breeze was the one that I had to use two index cards, both sides, really small writing, all the ways that I had harmed her. You know, and like I said things to her like, hey, I probably made it hard for you to love anyone else because I stole your idea of trust.
Yeah.
It was your first like real love and I got you pregnant and I just left.
Mm.
And so at the end of those, if you got a good sponsor, I think they'll have you ask a question at the end is, are there any way I've harmed you that I'm unaware of? Right. Which is usually where the magic happens, right? Like, a family member's like, in 1974, Thanksgiving dinner, you, you know, and you're like, holy shit. Like, right. You had no idea you did that to them.
Sure, yeah.
But Bree's the only person who said to me ever, I think you covered it.
Hmm.
And I said, well, what should I do? How can I make this right? She says, call me once a month so I know you're not dead. Hangs up.
Wow.
And I did it. And then we started talking once a week. And then we became really good friends over the course of about 6 months to a year, me and Bree. And then finally she says, do you want to meet your daughter?
Wow.
You know, and I met this incredible, like 13 and a half little girl, like all this spit and fire and spunk and, you know, all the things, right? And we're so alike and we've never met. That's like the incredible thing. We were so alike. I mean, geez. 21 now, and she would say, I'm nothing like you.
But of course. Well, she's contractually obligated as a 21-year-old right, to say right. That.
They will put her out the club if
that's
she...
That's correct.
We're hanging out, and in the course of that, Bree falls in love with me as I'm being a father to Jenna. And at first, I was very resistant to it because it was the first time I had ever showed up in my life with a pure motive.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to be Jenna's father and knew that I was behind the eight ball and would probably just end up being her friend and was okay with that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, was okay with, you know what, if this kid just calls me friend. So it was the first time I had ever done that, and I was afraid of messing with the, I don't know, the divine pH balance of that.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, oh, I don't want to add too much. But of course, you know, I want to be with this woman, right? Who's now a woman. And I'm learning what it means to be a man in a world where there are no good examples of masculinity. So I'm trying to figure that out, right? And we start dating. And we fall in love. We got married on April Fool's Day.
And how old's Jenna at that point?
Jenna's 16.
Was she at the wedding?
Yeah.
What did she do?
She stood with her mom.
Wow. That is just an unbelievable story. That is just, it is incredible. It is incredible.
Yeah.
I was just watching The Newsroom, that Aaron Sorkin HBO series.
Yeah. I love that show.
One of the characters said, asked somebody else, do you believe in God? And he said, yeah. She goes, I do too. And she goes, I think that we know we've violated a law of God when we can't put it back together.
Yeah.
Like when you cannot, there is no possible way to fix it.
Yeah.
And so whenever I see examples of you would think you can't put it back together and yet there is restoration and it's not to the original pure state before right. It was broken, obviously, right. but like it's so, I'm a reluctant hopeful person. Like yeah. I'm reluctant to be hopeful. But I still am. Like my cynicism does not yet outweigh my hopefulness. They're in a pretty tight race. But sometimes when I hear stories of restoration, like some kind of reconciliation, I fucking live for that. Like I'm desperate for it because everything I see in the world cannot be an occasion for despair.
Yeah. And it's a messy restoration, right? Like, I don't want people to hear the, I don't want people to hear the story.
No, it's perfect.
Yeah, no, it's messy. I mean, do me and Bree have tough days where we feel like sometimes we're living into this thing that everyone loves about this story, and she just wants me to stop pissing next to the toilet?
Right.
And I just want her to, like, not be as fearful about certain things, or sure, something, which right. is, like, her thing.
Well, in other words, you're married.
Right.
Okay. Right. So, like, fair enough. Right?
Do you know what I mean? Like,
but also, like, look, restoration is not the same as saying, I have now undone the harm. You didn't undo shit. None of those moments where you really should have been present in that child's life are now sort of undone by the fact that you eventually were.
Can I tell you when I knew Jenna trusted me?
Yeah.
We were a year and a half into living as a family. And she was doing something she wasn't supposed to be doing. And I, like, called her out on it. And, man, she let me fucking have it. She said, you ruined my fucking life. You destroyed everything. I've never had a family. I've never felt loved. I've never felt like I had any worth. You stole everything from me. And she screamed it, Nadia, 3 inches from my face. And I walked outside and I got on the phone with my friend and we wept tears of joy because we knew she trusted me enough to let me have it, which means she knew I wasn't leaving.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean? Because up until that point, I don't want to say the thing that makes him leave or makes things harder for him and mom. Up until that point, it was a lot of that stuff. But in that moment, she fucking took me to task. And it was the first time I felt like a father. So she thinks I'm outside crying because I'm sad. And I'm like so happy that like she trusts me finally.
Oh my gosh.
And she, to this day, will take occasion to let me have it.
Yeah.
And know that I'm in it with her.
You're not going somewhere.
Yeah, I'm in it with her. Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah.
So, Lenny, I don't even know what to say other than I'm so glad you're willing to to tell the whole story, you know, and to be honest about the super shitty parts, but also to be honest about the oddly hopeful parts. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
A blessing for Lenny. Lenny, I wish I could write cheery as fuck cards and slip them under your door. Little handwritten, glitter-laden blessings you can open up while you're in a room of your own that has a light switch. So that every time you felt like shit, you could open one up and be reminded that your greatest fear did not come true. Cards that say things like, "Congratulations, Lenny. You didn't turn into your father." It would be creepy were I to stand outside your door and do this, so instead, I have sent you a small gift to keep on your desk. It is a small, lighted Greyhound bus station sign meant for a model train set. I couldn't find an air freshener with the freshly cleaned bus toilet scent, so the sign will have to do. May it remind you of true freedom. And in the words of the Grateful Dead, that once in a while, you get shown the light in the strangest of places if you look at it right. And again, congratulations, friend. Love, Nadia. Amen. Next time on The Confessional, I speak with someone about the crime that landed him in San Quentin for 17 years.
And it just put this destructive force in the world that I just wish that that I wasn't that person that caused this.
In the meantime, enjoy this message a fellow listener left for us on my confessional hotline for a community segment I call Shit I'm Not Proud Of.
Hey, Nadia, this is Patrick from San Anselmo, California. So I spent a summer in Haiti when I was in college and got used to the food down there and then came home. Flew into the Atlanta airport, got to Zaxby's right before they were closing and was staying with some relatives my first night back before my parents could come and pick me up. Well, after getting used to 10 weeks of Haitian food, was not prepared for the extent of what some Zaxby's fried chicken, french fries, and sweet tea would do to my stomach, and was sleeping in my cousin's bed. But I woke up, thought I needed to pass gas. Was not gas. It was diarrhea. And woke up the next morning, had shit the bed, and I blamed my cousin's dog on it. The dog was the one who had crapped the bed, that it wasn't me. And my cousin believed me. And that's my confession for tonight.
Do you have some shit you're not proud of? Call 618-CONFESS and leave me a message about an embarrassing moment, and I might play it on the show. The Confessional is produced by House of Pod and Shameless Media, with support and spiritual guidance from The Moth and PRX. Our theme music was composed by Antoine Banks Williams.